Okay, we are live on the air, live around the world on WWTF Radio. This is What's the Buzz, America's Best Podcast. Before we get any further, I want to introduce the Pitbull, Amelia the Pitbull Chapman. My guests tonight are Ken Widener and Mike Lynch, co-authors of this incredible book. I'm going to tell you something. If this is not a movie in the next 2 years, call me. I'll make it happen.
Yes, he will.
I will make it happen. I'll make it happen. Mm-hmm. But, Milia.
Yes.
Are you ready?
Absolutely. Let's do it.
Let's rock. It's 4 o'clock in Los Angeles. It's 6 p.m. in Dallas, Texas, and 7 p.m. in Utica, New York. Hello, everybody. I'm Mad Don DeCipio, joined as I am each and every week by Amelia, the Pitbull, God help us, the Pitbull Chapman. How are you, Amelia?
Good. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm in a mood today. I feel pretty good.
Good.
I'm doing pretty good today. I had a good day today. You know why?
Why?
I didn't have to hear your mouth.
Shut up.
Ah, man. Two of my favorite people are back tonight. We are joined tonight by Mike Lynch and Ken Widener. They wrote this amazing, amazing book. I call this book the definitive dictionary of Alcatraz. This is like the Encyclopedia Britannica of Alcatraz. This book's amazing. There are a couple of guys who spent a painstaking better part of probably, I want to say, guys, about 6 years or so on this book. Sound about right?
Not quite six, but four or five.
Well, we're in the neighborhood, Mike.
Welcome back, close gentlemen. Enough.
Yeah, we're in the neighborhood for sure.
Well, actually, you know, this really kind of all started with me in 2012. So for me, it's been a lot longer than 6 or 7 years. But
yeah. In earnest, Ken, for you, this is kind of a lifetime. Really, it's a lifetime thing. You were born into this.
Well, that is true also. I was born right as a few days after Clarence shows up at Alcatraz. And so, yeah, I pretty much was born into it.
Yeah. And so that brings a unique perspective. We're going to talk about that tonight. One of the things we're going to do tonight is break down the planning, implementation, and execution of the escape itself, which is that's mind-blowing. It is utterly mind-blowing. The other thing we're going to do is we're going to quell some of the misnomers and misconceptions. We're going to sort through fact from fantasy, you know, myth from mythology, and find out where things came from, how they developed. You know, if you say something long enough in the public psyche, if you say it long enough, it's going to become true. You know, I'll give you a perfect example. You know, in 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue. Everybody says, 1492, Columbus discovered America. Well, no, it's not really how it happened. It wasn't until almost, you know, 1506, but that's a whole nother story. It doesn't rhyme with 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue, you know?
Or that trick question, when did the War of 1812 occur?
Yeah, exactly. Right? You know, this is the kind of thing we're talking about. I want to bring Ken up right into the big camera at the start here. Here's why we're going to do this. Tonight, we're going to sort through some of the misnomers and misconceptions. One of the biggest misnomers, Ken, and I want to hit it right from the gate, is that John, Clarence, and Frank somehow swam off the island. They swam to shore. They made it. That was one theory. The other one is that one or two of the guys were eaten by sharks, and only one made it to shore. That, folks, you can't. Am I lying, Mike? This stuff is out there.
No, lots of theories.
Yeah, exactly. So what I want to do right from jump tonight is, if you would, for me, Ken, try to set, let's set the record straight for like how it happened. We're going to talk tonight. You and Mike have been gracious enough, I should say, to come back and join us. This is part two. So let's get into where these crazy stories came from. Where did the idea of that they got eaten by sharks come? Like, where did this stuff come from?
Well, you know, the original, the very first theory that came out that they didn't make it, that they drowned, was actually from one of the head federal prison directors, James Bennett. He's actually the one who originally said by them finding the pouch with the items that belonged to John and Clarence England, that it was proof that they had some type of malfunction in their escape process and they drowned. Otherwise, they would not have carelessly lost this important piece of information or items that they supposedly carried with them.
Yeah.
But I will say this, though, you know, as far as the swim itself, every single year, in fact, it's about to occur in just a couple of weeks from now, there are 2,000 people that were into the water just outside of Alcatraz. And I was actually one of them in 2016. And I swam all the way from Alcatraz to the Marina Green. And I did it within 49 minutes. So, you know, I mean, if it was needed and someone had to swim,
yeah,
you could do it. You know, I mean, it's not really a difficult swim. I didn't find it difficult. And I had never swam before a distance like that.
The other,
I was a newbie.
The other misnomer, Ken, is that the waters off of San Francisco are shark infested and it's a breeding ground for sharks. They'll get eaten up. You know, they'll tear you from limb from limb. Folks, I'm not making a word of this up.
Not making it up.
That was definitely what they would tell the prisoners, the inmates, because it scared the living crap out of them, you know.
Yeah.
But to be honest with you, the only sharks that are in there are bottom feeding sharks that would never even harm you. Occasionally. Now, there have been reports of great whites that have ventured in under the Golden Gate and into the bay, but it's not a very it's not a something that happens all the time. So, like I said, every year 2,000 people swim that in the Alcatraz escape from Alcatraz triathlon. So,
yeah,
as far as I know, over the almost 20 something years that they've been doing it, no one has been eaten by sharks. And came after me.
While we're talking about that, Amelia and I were talking off camera. She's got a question for you guys regarding that. So go ahead, Amelia, ask them that question we were talking about earlier. And
Yes. About Alan West. You know how he was the fourth person that did not get away with them. Do you think that if he would have gone with them, do you think he would have held them back from escaping, or maybe have gotten away with them to where they would have probably robbed and then got caught again?
I'll answer part of it, and then I'll let Mike answer another part of it. I actually believe that if Alan West had gone with them, Frank Morris would have killed him.
Oh, wow.
He had already planned to do him in. And Alan West actually found out about it through John and or Clarence that that was going to happen. And I personally believe that that's the reason why he chose conveniently not to not to finish his cell digging out. And even it was confirmed by Whitey Bulger in one of his letters.
I see.
Yes. Mike, do you agree with that, or you have another take on it?
There was a possibility of that. In Whitey's letters, he talked about how Alan was a little too communicative with the other inmates about their escape plans. And when Frank Morris found out about it, he was furious. Because in the prison system, and this isn't just Alcatraz, this is all prisons, one of the things that the guards do is they cultivate snitches from the population.
Yeah.
And so you don't know who the snitches are, which is keeps them alive. Because of course, if the inmates found out, your life has taken a very dark turn at that point.
Yeah.
And so you didn't talk to people you didn't trust because they could rat you out. And of course, the inmates that do that, you know, they get lesser sentences or they get special privileges. You know, there's a benefit for them, of course.
Yeah.
And so when Morris found out that West was talking, he told him, whenever you go outside to the yard, you're with us. Whenever you eat in the kitchen area, you're with us. You don't talk to anybody without us around. And he had actually had a knife that he had carried with him, and it's in the FBI report. And then also Whitey Bulger mentions the same thing. And Morris had said to West that if we get caught, if anything happens before the escape, the first thing I'm going to do is kill you.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And so the question was, did West believe that Morris was going to do it after they escaped? They're on the beach by themselves, getting ready to go into the water. And I think West feared that that would be the point that Morris would kill him. And then the three of them would go on their way, or at least that was a possibility. So no way to know if that would happen. Yeah. But I think West was very fearful of Morris. And so, like Ken said, he
here's the strange thing about that. And in as much as Whitey Bulger, James Whitey Bulger, was a stone cold, ruthless killer, in this context, in the context of Alcatraz, call me crazy, fellas, but he actually sounds like he's been kind of helpful.
Well, actually, up until that time frame when he was in Alcatraz, you know, he wasn't the killer that he would eventually become.
Right. Oh, okay.
Yeah. So the monster that he actually became is really another part of this story that happens to him later on when he goes back to Atlanta.
This and what the government does to perspective, him. Isn't it? It really
is. Yes. I mean, you know, Bulger is in my short time of writing with him and talking to him, I did learn, you know, he was a very dedicated man. Now, he, like you said, he was a ruthless killer. And you did not want to get on his wrong side.
No, no. Sure.
And so, but he was a very dedicated person. And the one thing he hated the most was a snitch. Anybody who would rat somebody out, that was like the lowest of the low to him. So
the worst. In mob life, you know, the worst thing you can be is a snitch. Oh, the only thing lower than a snitch is somebody who committed child crimes. That's the only thing lower than a snitch.
I always thought it was a dead snitch.
In fact, we did that show last night.
Right, exactly.
Right.
A dead snitch is a good snitch, right?
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah.
Well, they're lower in the ground. And
some of the misnomers and misconceptions about the escape, of course, that, you know, eaten by sharks, that they didn't make it. When was, in your research and to your satisfaction, when was proof positive the first piece of information you got that said to you, no question about it, no doubt in my mind, these guys, all three of these guys made it?
That was in 2015 when we discovered the photograph of them in Brazil in the early 1970s. And mm-hmm. it's been verified by not only the U.S. Marshals, an FBI agent. It has been looked at by 5 to 6 independent companies, all positively identifying John Anglin in that photo. And so to me, that is the starting point. So you've just proved that they survived because, I mean, how can John be in a photograph in 1970 and be in the bay at the bottom, you know, rotting away and all that's left is his bones?
Yeah.
Clearly that did not happen.
Ken, didn't you know that?
What's that?
He got eaten by sharks. Didn't you know that?
Right.
So, you know, from that point, Mike and myself pretty much said, okay, we know the outcome. So now let's go back and figure out exactly how it happened.
Well, and that's I could not have segued this anymore perfectly. That's a perfect segue. And I'm going to bring Mike in for this one. Okay, Mr. Lynch, you are up. You're up to bat here. Okay. So let's talk about the implementation, the planning, the execution. I have a question for you about logistics. The question is simply this. How big were John, Clarence, and Frank in relation to each other? Were they around the same size, height, weight? Give me some demos here.
Well, according to the FBI report, John and Clarence were both about 5'10", 5'11". They weighed about 160 pounds. They were a little on the slender side.
All right.
And I think that was just because of years of working on the farm. You know, they were muscular. They're very strong, but, you know, they weren't big men.
Right.
Frank Morris was a little shorter. I think he was about 5'8", and also very slender. So just a few inches shorter than them. So, you know, Morris being more average size and John and Clarence a little bit above average height wise.
The question comes up because I spent some time today painstakingly looking at the size of the holes that these guys had to shimmy through. I was wondering, just from a logistical standpoint, this is why I'm asking you a question about logistics. From a logistical standpoint, how much wiggle room did they have? And I don't mean that facetiously. I mean, literally, how much wiggle room did they have? Because we're talking about the hole underneath the sink looked maybe, and I mean, I'm being generous when I say maybe 13 or 14 inches wide.
That's probably about right.
Yeah. And okay, so I'm in the ballpark, and maybe 7 or 8 inches high. And in other words, about the size of a cinder block.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. Essentially, that's what we're talking about, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How did they get through there? How did these obviously tall, slender to medium build guys, they got through this hole? And that's hole number one. And then I'm perplexed and I'm looking at the roof of Alcatraz and there's about the size of a donut hole that they had to shimmy through. How did they explain this to me, Mike? What happened? How did they get through this stuff?
So I'll start with the air vents in the back of the cells. One of the things that they had discovered was, and this is actually in the Clint Eastwood movie, they do reference this. You know, Alcatraz opened in 1934, but it had been there actually many years before as a military prison.
Right.
And then when it became, you know, a federal prison for non-military inmates, they expanded it and they made it more attuned to what they needed for a prison to be. But it had been there for decades, many decades. Sure. And because of the salt air in San Francisco, over time, as the years passed, it kind of softened the cement that they use for the prison. And so they were using basically spoons and files. Alan West had actually found some files.
I never thought that.
Some months before between the cells, the cell blocks are, their backs are against each other. Between them, there's about a 3-foot wide utility corridor for electrical and for plumbing.
Yeah.
And West was sort of a handyman kind of a person. So he had kind of free reign around the prison to just kind of do fix-up jobs. And they had done some repairs to the plumbing. Wes was sent in there to kind of clean up the mess. And then that's when he found the files. And then he goes to John and said, hey, I found some files. And that's what really triggers the plan in from that point on. John had already been planning an escape, but he hadn't quite figured out how they were going to do it yet. And when Wes approached him with the files, now they had real tools to work with to try to work on the escape. And because of the discovery of the soft cement, they started smuggling out spoons from the kitchen area. And, you know, they, you know, broke them off, broke off the spoon part of it and sharpened the edge. And then they actually would tape the spoons together. And when they were picking away at the cement, you have like four or five spoon handles that are sharpened digging at the same time. It's not a single spoon handle. It's multiple spoon handles. So your work is going much faster.
So, Mike, let me ask you then. So at some point, somebody has to make a decision to try to use a spoon to to dig at this cement, this concrete, whatever it is, right?
Right.
How soon after this did they discover, hey, this stuff is pretty pliable here? Was it immediate that somebody tipped them off that, hey, maybe, you know, this brick isn't as solid as it looks? Or
we don't know. At one point, you know, from when they were incarcerated there, because John arrived there in October of 60 and Clarence showed up in January of 61, a few months later. You know, so after, let's just say early 61, at what point do they figure out that they can dig out the back of the cells? We're, we don't have a specific timeline for that. But it's we obviously figured it out. Now, it was also common knowledge that on top of the cell block, you referenced the air vent on top.
Yeah.
That was common knowledge that there were multiple air vents on the top, and all of them have been sealed up except for the one. For some reason, they didn't seal the one, and they just put bars across the opening so nobody can get through there. And that, of course, was the way that they made it to the roof. So they already knew about that because the inmates had just sort of talked about it from time to time.
That's remarkable. Well, it's fascinating. Go ahead, Ken.
I was going to say, I can tell you how I went through John's hole in his cell, because I went through it.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. You did, you actually made it through?
Oh, yeah, I actually went through it. And okay, so
before we get into that, let me just venture a guess here. I'm going to say you're about 170, 175.
Well, at the time that I went through, I was 175.
Okay, so there you go.
I was a little bit smaller than I am now. We were out there for the 50th anniversary, and they pretty much treated the family. I had my mom and my her sister out there, and they pretty much let us go anywhere we wanted to go. And we went into the cells, and at the time, the I was trying to think of the park ranger. His name was Cantwell. He, in fact, he even let me drive the truck, the famous truck that's on the island. I drove it around.
Oh, no.
I mean, you pretty much, you could ask, you know, could I do this? And he'd say, sure. But when we were in the cell, he said, you want to take a shot at going through the hole? And I was like, well, I can try. But I wasn't real sure how to do it. And he actually told me how they believed they did it, that they would take their arm and they would stick it like this, and they would lay on their back and they would stick one
then
the other arm would lay in between their legs, and then they would use their legs to push through. That's what they believe happened.
How long did it take you to do that?
Do what?
How long did it take you to actually do that? To make
It took me about a good 10 minutes to work myself up to wanting to do it. But then once I got in, I didn't want to get stuck, so it didn't take long.
Claustrophobia.
I kept pushing through real quick.
And you're a fairly tall guy, like you're.
I'm at the time I was 5'11 and a half, so I mean I was probably about the same height that Clarence was,
so
and
you were
probably
able
about
to
the same
kind of,
weight.
So basically, you're able to size and weight to recreate the escape. Okay, now that's the that's the hole underneath the sink. That famous.
That's correct.
Missing. Okay. Did you ever figure out how they shimmied up that air shaft?
Well, they had three people. So once that shaft is actually, I've been up there and looked at it. It looks small in photographs, but it is actually big enough for someone to go through it.
Is it
especially
really?
If you're motivated and you want to get the heck out of Dodge.
Oh yeah, for sure, right?
So I mean, you know, you had
never moved, right.
Yeah, you had someone below that could lift you up and push you up to the vent.
So
and then once you got up there, you would turn around and help someone else by reaching your hand down and pulling them up. So I never got the opportunity, nor was I asked, nor did I ask, could I go through it? But I believe I could have gone through it if I had wanted to.
Wow.
Remarkable. Amelia, questions for Ken and Mike.
When you did your research as well, I know that a lot of the prisoners kept quiet, as you were saying earlier, that they keep quiet in a sense to where they thought, okay, as soon as they break out of prison, they're going to figure it out and they're going to close the prison so we can all escape or all go to different prisons.
Well, the inmates, a number of the inmates, you know, despite, you know, Wes talking and Morris trying to keep them quiet, they did have to rely on other inmates for supplies and materials that they needed. You know, they needed cement for the raft and for the life vest. They needed electrical equipment for the drill that they discovered that one of the, it was a vacuum cleaner had an extra motor in it, and they used that as a makeshift. Well, they needed a drill bit. Right. So they got that from one of the shops. And of course they needed the raincoats, and over 50 raincoats were used for the rafts and the life vests. Well, they got them from the other inmates. So, you know, they start figuring out something's going on here. There's a plan in motion.
Yeah.
And nobody snitched, not a single person, you know, said anything to the guards. And one of the things that, again, Whitey Bulger said in the letter is that the morning of June 12th, when it was discovered, when the guards finally discovered the escape, you know, because they, you know, they had morning counts before they went to the dining hall.
Right.
Yeah.
And of course, in the three cells, John, Clarence, and Frank didn't come out of their cells. And there's multiple stories about they went to Frank Morris's cell first to get him out. And the guard slapped him to get him out of bed. They opened up the cell. Hey, Morris, get up, kind of a thing. He's not moving. He slaps him. Well, the head rolls onto the floor, and the guard screams. he jumps back and he screams because his first thought was somebody had murdered him and they cut off his head.
No. Oh, that's funny. I'll tell you what, that's a great segue, Amelia. Mm-hmm. And Mike, I'm glad that you told that story because I want to go there for a minute. I want everybody to kind of, those of you that are watching us on Roku TV, YouTube TV, any of our streaming platforms, and those around the world on radio, for the benefit of those watching, we're going to take a look at a piece of film here. I'm going to stop this film at various spots, and we're going to talk about it. So let's begin. Okay, so what we're looking at here, first of all, before we go any further with this, did you guys have any trouble acquiring original materials? And if so, how did you make the goodwill to get these clearly, you know, valuable letters and envelopes and documentation, photographs? It's a veritable treasure trove here, guys.
Well, actually, our family actually owns all these letters. We have them in our possession today. So all those letters that you're looking at the very top, I actually have some of them in my possession here. And then some of them are with my other brother, my younger brother, and some are with my mom.
Wow.
Amazing. I was wondering about that because I didn't know how much was in the public domain, how many were in museums.
Well, a lot of them are public domain because they were, like, for example, there's the photograph of Clarence in the upper right. His dummy head in the bed. Well, those photographs were after the escape were taken by the FBI.
Yeah.
So that because those are government records, we have access to them, as are the mug shots that were taken them over the years. And of course, Ken's family provided a number of family photographs. Of the brothers and the family, you know, before the escape and after the escape.
Yeah,
and then others are on websites that we found that are public domain. And for the ones that weren't public domain, we had to get permission to publish them. In some cases, fees were paid because it's a service they're providing. In other cases, they did it free of charge as long as we gave them credit for it.
Yeah. That's what we cared about.
So it was multiple sources, multiple ways of getting it, but we made sure that everything we put into the book was not done without permission.
We are looking at a photo here that screams one of these pictures is not like the others. We're looking at a number of mug shots. We're looking at people involved in the Anglin family. We're looking at Mickey Cohen. A number, you know, familiar faces and a couple of guys in the upper left-hand corner that clearly don't look like they belong there, Bobby and John Kennedy. Can you, either one of you guys, explain the Kennedy connection to Alcatraz?
Well, the Kennedys were the men that was instrumental in putting Mickey Cohen into Alcatraz.
Oh,
they
wow.
were instrumental in trying to bring down as much crime bosses as they could get their hands on. And, you know, you were talking about the closing of Alcatraz. And if the inmates really were holding hope that if the escape was successful, that it would have been closed.
Right.
Well, actually, Robert Kennedy was already in the process of trying to close the island even before the escape.
Oh,
he felt like that the prison was too expensive. It was too old.
Mm-hmm.
It was causing, you know, too much security risk. And he felt like there were other prisons that could house these men and give them the same security that they needed. So it was really already in the works of trying to close it.
Amazing.
Wow.
We're looking at the next set of photos is, of course, in the upper left-hand corner is Ruth and
Helen.
Helen. Those, of course, are the sisters that dated the Anglin brothers, and a number of interesting artifacts. Clearly, there's a shank there. There's the now famous paper mache dummy head. Of course, Frank Morris is there. Mickey Cohen is photographed there. A number of interesting artifacts. Are any of these photographed artifacts in a museum anywhere? Does any of this stuff still actually exist?
Well, the paintings still exist, and we have those in our possession today. There was actually a third one, but it was lost a long time ago, and we're not real sure what happened to it. Everything else is supposedly, it was supposed to have been in the hands of the FBI, mm-hmm. who then in turn gave it over to the U.S. Marshals. Well, the U.S. Marshal Services then turned it over to the archives in San Francisco. So they're not even in possession of it anymore.
Remarkable.
Wow.
And again,
that is remarkable.
In fact, I mean, this entire case is just like something out of Bizarro Land. It's like, did this really happen? Yeah, it did, and that's what makes it incredible. It really is remarkable.
I just want to go back to one point.
Sure, yeah, Mike.
About the inmates escaping, you were saying, you know, were they hoping that if they escaped, they would close the prison down?
Yes.
I don't know if the inmates were aware that Alcatraz was in the process of being closed down at some future point, but one of the things that Whitey talks about in the letter is that on the morning when they did escape, when it was everyone found out about it, he said, we all escaped that morning.
Yeah.
Like every inmate in the prison escaped that morning, and it lifted their spirits. They were cheering, they were clapping, and the guards, of course, were upset with them telling them to be quiet. And then, so it was more about, you know, helping them get out because it was kind of thumbing their nose at the authorities. That was what the inmates' motivations were.
We're looking at a number of photographs, of course, in the upper left-hand corner and across the top of the photo. We're looking at, of course, John and Clarence Anglin, photographed in Brazil. The gentleman to the upper right-hand corner, Ken, who is that wearing the glasses? Is that Fred?
That is Fred Breezy. That is in 1992. He was invited over to the Anglin family house, and sitting right beside him off to the right is a tape recorder. And then the hand you see, that's my mom. She actually had, for some reason, the fourth to, you know, to record this meeting. So we actually have the cassette player with him as he's talking and telling the story of him going into Brazil and meeting with the brothers.
He recorded this for posterity.
Pardon?
He recorded this for posterity.
Well, I don't know. I guess he knew my mom was recording it. He probably just didn't care. But, you know, for whatever reason, she recorded it.
What she got to lose?
We have it. Right? Well, that's true. He had not too long been let out of prison.
Right.
He got out of prison in 86. He got caught smuggling drugs into the country. But the photo that you see of John and Clarence, that was the meeting when he handed my mom not only that photo, but the photo of their house, their community that they had set up for workers, because their farm was huge. And they had a lot of people that worked for them. And so they had this little community where all the families who worked on their farm lived.
We are looking at a photo of Alcatraz Island. This is The Rock.
Wow.
Before we went on the air, we had a conversation about logistics and the setup of the island. And it's, as you can see, and as I said on our last program, it is a very small place. And the building itself, the main prison building, is a very compact, linear structure. Ken tells us before we go on the air tonight that it's essentially a long hallway with like other little compartments, right, Ken? Is that how you described it?
Yeah, I mean, if you walk in the building, there was like a basement to it also.
Oh, wow.
But it was pretty much kind of, think of it wide open, and you had different like hallways that they had different names for the right. corridors that they had the different cells looking at each other. Like I said, they had one that was called Broadway, Park Place, Michigan Avenue. And so, you know, they had a two-tier type. You had cells on top of another cell. And it was pretty much open. And I believe they had it that way because they wanted to be able to keep an eye on everyone in there at one time.
So if you hear what Ken's saying, essentially Monopoly was the setup here.
Except they wouldn't collect.
Yes.
Pretty much a
light. They didn't get a get out of jail free card though.
Or collect $200 after they pass go.
Exactly. This is a life-size Monopoly game here. What we're talking about. And this is the actual photo taken by, I guess, the police or the federal government. But you can see the head is still in the bed there. And take note, Amelia, I want you to just really just take a look at what we're talking about here. Look at the size of that hole.
It's very, very
small. And
then
look at Ken and imagine him getting his behind through that.
It'd be like hard to just move your shoulder in there.
I can't even imagine that you got your shoulders through that. How?
Yeah.
Your
head. I mean, I know it's you have to go like this, but still.
You know, look, I'm all for, you know, I believe in magic and all that stuff too. But this is like, you got to do a disappearing act like to get through that hole there, brother.
Yeah, it's definitely tight. It's not a very big opening. So.
Yeah, they had
not at all. And it's hard for me to imagine, you know, let alone one person getting through, but a couple we're talking about.
And the cuts and scrapes they would have suffered.
Remarkable. I can't fathom. And again, this is just me. I mean, I'm looking at, you know. The physicality here, and I'm looking at the physics of it and the geometry of it, and I'm trying to because I'm pretty good that way, and I'm just trying to figure out how the hell is somebody getting through this thing. I just don't see it, but it's crazy. But that's it. Here's another one, Amelia.
Wow,
this is another photo of yet another one of these heads. You know, one head is facing one direction. Of course, This is facing another direction.
Yeah, and the back of it, within passing by, you could tell somebody looks like somebody with regular hair.
Yeah, and you got to remember, it's dark. And so it's not like you have a flashlight that you're shining. They pretty typically, from what I understand, the guards would not shine lights in on them.
Yeah.
Pretty much like around, but not directly onto them. And so if you're you're really, and you're not expecting an escape that night.
Exactly.
I mean, you probably just walk right by it and said, okay, I see it. I see someone in the bed, and you go on.
Yeah.
To the next.
And it's also important to remember too that they didn't do it just the night of the escape. You know, they put their dummy head the night of the escape and they got away. They did it multiple times because they had to keep going up to the top of the cell block.
Yeah.
That was their work area. That's where they had all their supplies. That's where they had all the things that they were constructing for the escape. So they did this multiple times.
Yeah. And we have to point that out, that this was done several times so that they could take the time to dig.
Mm-hmm. You know, that and they were constructing the raft that they used.
We're going to talk about that here in about 2 minutes.
Yep.
We sure are. But I want people to take a look. If you're if you're on YouTube TV or Roku or any or Tubby TV, this is probably the most famous plaster Paris head in the world, and that's real hair, folks.
Yes.
That's real human hair.
Well, now I will give you something, an insight on these things that.
Yes, sir.
I believe there. I believe it might have been put in the book, but they gave names. Going. They gave names to every one of the heads. They named them like Ork. I think it was Ork was one of them. And I'm trying to remember the other names, but these were names that they used as kids, nicknames that they gave each other. And that's the names that they gave them as they made them.
Remarkable. It's fascinating when we think about.
Oh, well, here's another one too.
Not two, but three guys.
Yep.
Painstakingly digging a hole, you know, like a cup, maybe sometimes for 5 or 10 minutes a night and then just being done with it. But
they dug longer because what happened was from 5 to 9, they'd already had their dinner. They were brought back to their cells. They had done another head count. And so from 5 to 9, they had what they would call kind of like free time in their cells. And that's when the inmates around the prison would practice their musical instruments. If they were working on painting, just any kind of craft kind of a thing.
Yeah.
And so they timed it so that when other inmates were making noise with their instruments, that's when the four of them were digging. It was covering the sounds of the digging. And that was done intentionally, obviously, so that the guards couldn't hear what they were doing. And of course you had John and Clarence were in the cells next to each other and Frank and Alan West were next to each other. And so one would dig and the other would keep an eye on the guards. And if the guard was coming, you just sort of make a little tapping sound and they would stop and just pretend to do something else like reading. And then you go back to work after they walk by. So they were doing this for hours a day for a long time, for weeks.
I love to dig
out all the back of the cell.
I showed the last time you guys were on, I pointed out something that to me was blaring. I showed a photograph with a guitar in it. It was a cell, and there was a guitar
that was Clarence
in the background. Okay. You remember that, Ken?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Yes, I know which one it was.
I showed that photograph to a young police officer. The first thing he said, the first thing out of his mouth was, how the hell did they get a guitar in there? How did they do that? First of all, the thing about them, a guitar is made of wood and wire. It's a weapon. It's a weapon. It's a musical instrument, yes. Mm-hmm. But you can strangle somebody with those wires. You could take that guitar and make a giant spear out of it if you wanted to, really. Think about it.
What's not generally known about Alcatraz was actually there was a band that existed there. They were called the Rock Islanders. And in the band, they had all the, they had all the, those who could play an instrument were in the band, and they used to play on the weekends and on holidays, and they would entertain their fellow inmates. So, you know, Frank Morris had an accordion. Al Capone, who wasn't part of the escape, he had died before, but he actually learned to play the harmonica while he was at Alcatraz. He actually learned music while he was there.
I have, my town has a connection to Capone. I will tell you, this is true. And it's a historic site here. Al Capone had a summer house here in Clementon, New Jersey. It's 3 minutes up the street from where I am right now. And it just sold for $2.75 million.
Wow.
Yeah. I'm not even kidding. I'm not even playing when I tell you this. For real. Yep. Clementon, New Jersey. Al Capone's house. Google it. It's there.
Anyway, so instruments in the cells were very common. It was not a big deal at Alcatraz.
It's fascinating, though, Mike. I mean, think about it just from a common sense standpoint. Like, you got these prisoners, and you have something that could be made into a weapon.
That's true.
Now, yeah. I know it's a musical instrument. So is a trumpet or a clarinet or any. But you could take a clarinet and a trumpet and shave them down and make, you know, any number of weapons out of that. I mean,
that's true.
Somebody like Frank Morris would have a field day with that, especially getting Popular Mechanics magazine. Oh, they'll tell you how to make a bomb out of a bar of soap.
Yeah.
MacGyver. That's some MacGyver stuff there, brother.
Right. Early MacGyver. MacGyver
stuff. Amelia, questions for Mike and Ken.
Yeah, I know that the Englund brothers, they grew up here in my area where I live at now in Florida, you know, doing the picking, guess whatever they could, like, you know, strawberries or onions or whatever it was. And
tomatoes.
I know close. Tomatoes. You know, they were
oranges.
Close. Yeah, and would they, I know that they would rob places, of course, not to get anybody hurt. Was that because of the influence from their parents to make sure that nobody got hurt? Or is it just because of their conscience?
Probably. I mean, they definitely, the influence came from them going to church. My grandparents were very religious people. Every one of the kids went to a Pentecostal church there locally, not too far from where they were living. So maybe that might have had, you know, a play into them not wanting to hurt anyone. But they really and truly, all they really wanted to do was, they did not want to live the lifestyle that they saw their mom and dad live.
That's true.
Struggling, you know, to feed 14 kids, working themselves to death. And they just really wanted something more out of life than what they saw the road that they were on was going to carry them to. And so, you know, I mean, and in some sense, I mean, I think everybody can pretty much understand, you know, you look at the life that you're about to be dealt, and you don't like that. And so the only way that, I mean, they didn't have the money to go to college, much less pretty much even finish, you know, school.
Yeah.
So,
well, we know that Ken Widener is a deeply religious man because he's got a giant halo around his head right now.
A golden halo.
Golden halo.
Mike Lynch, what's the takeaway from this? What's the takeaway from the Alcatraz story? The lesson, in every story, there's a lesson. What's
the
lesson here?
They, you know, it's sort of the resiliency of the human spirit. You know, these people were taken to a place. Now, they deserve to go there. They were bank robbers. You know, they were not innocent men. So they, you know, going to a federal prison was what they should have gotten. And we don't whitewash them in the story saying that they were Robin Hoods and they were saints. We, you know, they were criminals.
Right.
On the other hand, you know, they felt that they had gotten a bad deal, you know, being not only convicted of the federal charge, but also of the state charge. And I don't think we brought this up last week. But when they had done the state case, which was the second one, you know, of course they were convicted because they had already pled guilty to the federal charge. The prosecutor told John and Clarence and Alfred, who was sent to another prison, he told them that when you finish your federal time and you come back to Alcatraz, when you come back to Alabama to do your state time, you're not going to get out alive. And Ken spoke with his grandfather, and, you know, they overheard the prosecutor say that to them, that threatening them that they're not going to come out. And Whitey Bulger also said in the letters that Frank Morris was also escaping Alcatraz for the same reason, except this was in Louisiana for him.
Yeah.
And so he knew that if he went back to Louisiana, he was not going to come out alive. And so for the three of them, their reason for doing it was, for them, it was survival. And they were going to do everything that they possibly could to get out, because they knew sooner or later they were going to get sent back and that was going to be the end of them. And so they felt, yeah, because they were dealt an unfair blow, that they had the right, if you want to use that word, to get out and try to, yeah, try to, you know, stay alive. And eventually that's what they did. So remarkable. They found the way to do it, and they used the skills that they had learned over the years, both growing up on the farm, and also the many escape attempts, the many incarcerations they had prior to that. And they were experts at getting out of something that they shouldn't have been able to do, but they did.
Yeah.
And you just have to, despite what you think of them personally, you have to admire their tenacity and their ingenuity to make it happen. And the courage. Yeah.
That brother, I admire their cojones. Let me tell you something. They got some chutzpah. We will be back, folks, in 2 minutes and 2 seconds right after this. What's the Buzz Popcast? Welcome to K-Pop Radio in Seoul, South Korea. Welcome aboard and welcome to The Buzz. What's the Buzz welcomes Radio 2 from Belgium. Welcome aboard and welcome to The Buzz. For expert body work and collision repair, there's only one place in Clementon, New Jersey. It's Bruce's Collision Center at 114 Whitehorse Pike in Clementon, New Jersey. Call Bruce at 856-783-1475. And tell him the Mad Dog sent you from WWTF Radio, global and around the world.
Do you have sweaty balls or volleyball netty balls? It's time to make them ready balls. The Manscaped.com Lawnmower 3.0 will do the job and clean your knob with its patented no-nick head, so your head will function as desired. Enter promo code WrestlingFuture for a generous 20% discount. That's enter WrestlingFuture for a 20% discount. Manscaped.com and Wrestling with the Future, going balls to the walls with Manscaped.com and the Lawnmower 3.0, your balls will thank you, and so will we.
What's the Buzz? America's Best Podcast returns with Frank. I'm sorry. With Frank, I was going to say with Frank, John, and Clarence. How about with Ken and Mike? Ken Widener and Mike Lynch are the authors of the definitive Alcatraz saga. It's Alcatraz, Last Escape. This is how it really happened, folks. Forget about what you see in the movies. You know, some of them are accurate, but they take poetic license. This is the real deal. They spent the better part of almost 6 years, 5.5 years or so, putting this book together painstakingly. You'll see photos, documents, and a plethora. There's no shortage of something for everyone in this book. It's got greed, sex. It's got lust, power, money, gangsters, strippers. It's got some politicians in there, too. Mm-hmm. But it's got a story of three guys that were determined not to be complacent anymore. They made their own way out. I got to say, hey, hats off to John, Clarence, and Frank. And I hope they live long lives. And we're going to talk about that right now. The idea of somebody writing a letter. We went through this, and it's been clearly it's been proven a fake. But has anyone to date, Ken, in your family, has anyone to date received a definitively authentic correspondence from either John or Clarence up to the point where you may believe they have passed away?
Not that we believe that they have passed away. I would say that the last person to actually have a correspondence with them would have been their older brother. He kept in contact with them all the way up until his death. 2006, I believe, is when my uncle passed away. But he was in constant contact with them up until that point. You know, I just don't believe that they would have chanced in any way, even though they were safe where they were at. They were married. They had children. There was no way that they were going to be brought back. But I think they liked it that way because I believe they did come back occasionally. Mm-hmm. And because no one really kind of knew who they were and what they looked like, they were able to travel without having to be feared of, you know, getting caught. If someone knew where they were at and knew what they looked like, then, of course, that would have prevented them from coming back into the United States.
Well, let's talk about that. That's a really great point. They were able to change their appearance substantially, drastically, upon their release. You know, a pair of glasses and a mustache and beard go a long way, especially when you've been out of the public eye for quite a while. And the police, of course, are using photographs of the time, you know, clearly dated materials, right?
Right.
So when Fred Breezy, you know, finally gets them to Brazil, they're not looking like John and Clarence, you know, mugshot this way. They're looking like different guys at this point, correct?
Well, I'm not sure how much they would have changed. So, you know, the escape occurs in the summer of 62. They go directly into Mexico. We believe that they're there until at least the end of 1963, maybe going into 1964. So then they travel down into Brazil. Now, you know, we've met with people in Brazil, and it was in the late 60s that they remember the three Americans showing up at this town. So, you know, their appearance might not have changed as much, but, you know, I do believe if you look at that photo that was taken in the early 70s, they were definitely heavier than they were when they were in Alcatraz. So started eating better and, you know, they started growing beards and, you know, they were just, you know, they took care of themselves probably better than they did in a prison. Yeah. And they were a lot happier. So.
Yeah. The other question I had along that line, how old would they have been? On June 12th, 62.
Oh my gosh. Now you're challenging me. I believe they were in their 30s. I know they were in their 30s.
Early
30s. I was thinking maybe John, because John was older than Clarence by 11 months. Mm-hmm. I believe Clarence was, John was 34 and Clarence might have been 33. And I might actually have it 1 year off.
Well, I'm asking because I took a really good look. I have that Brazil picture where the two of the guys are standing in front of that giant rock there. I have that photo. I blew it up today, and I really examined it well. Mm-hmm. In that picture, and just from my perception, they appear in that picture to be either in their late 30s, early to mid 40s, but in both cases, they don't appear to me to be any older than 45 tops.
Oh yeah, they were definitely not 45 in that
photo. Okay, so we're talking about they're fairly young then in 62, around 30 to 33 maybe tops.
Yes. Okay. Yep.
All right. So the question then becomes, how long could they possibly have lived without tipping off to anybody? That I'm sure, you know, particularly John, his psychology is that he's the family guy. He's the one that writes the letters. He's the one that keeps in touch with mom. You know, Clarence, on the other hand, you know, he's just kind of happy to be there. But it seems to me that John is the guy, he's the communicator. That's what I call him. So, I mentioned that on the last show.
So let me paint another picture for you.
Okay.
The day after the escape, the FBI shows up at my grandparents' home.
Okay.
And for the next 10 years, they harass the family so much that they come in and they threaten every single family member. If you have any knowledge of where these men are, if you aided in any way, if we find out that you, you know, gave anything to these men, if we find them, you will be going to prison. And so every single family member was absolutely scared to death. Mm-hmm. So with that, I don't believe that John nor Clarence would have ever put their family in risk or any type of harm's way by mm-hmm. writing them. And yeah. however they communicated with their older brother, they yeah. did communicate with him. And I'm not real sure how that was. Maybe it was through Fred Breezy transporting that information, because they weren't looking at Fred Breezy. They yeah. didn't even know who Fred Breezy was at that time.
Well, that's the other question. There are other individuals here who were, and I don't want to say aided and abetted, because that's a legal definition, but there were individuals who were friendly with the Anglin brothers on the outside. Is it possible that they were given shelter, safe shelter, by someone other than family members that perhaps for the sake of, you know, no one getting in trouble, they had to remain, you know, quiet and still, or, you know, shelter in place, for lack of a better term?
No, I believe they left that night. They left the United States. Mm-hmm. They did go in. In fact, we know this because Fred Breezy is the one who flew them out of the country yeah. into Mexico. And he even says that the next morning they were just north of Mexico City fueling up their plane when they actually heard the announcement over the radio of the escape. So they were already in Mexico. And so, yeah. you know, this was a one-way path for them. It was a, you yeah. leave the country, just like my grandfather told them to do. And James Whitey Bulger told them, you leave yeah. the country, you never look back, right. and you never come back.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's exactly how it played out.
It's hard to do, though, especially when you're a guy who spent his time in prison writing letters to mom and sending mm-hmm. her, you know, Christmas cards and all this other mm-hmm. kind of stuff. That had to be hard psychologically. I'm trying to get a profile, a workup here of the personalities. The other thing you mentioned was Fred Breezy. I would love to have been a fly on the wall during that conversation, brother. I want to tell you what. Were you there during that conversation?
No, I was not there, but like I said, I do have the cassette mm-hmm. tape.
Do we know, Ken, if there was anything said at that time that may have maybe slipped out of Fred's mouth?
Yes.
I'm trying yes. to yes. find.
Yes, he did. Yes, he did. Maybe, that is actually how I found the farm that we ultimately, Mike and myself, along with Josh Gates in Expedition Unknown, we take him yeah. to the location that I found, and I did it with Google Maps. I mean, I knew the location. I knew the information that Fred Breezy had said.
Yeah.
And he gave certain pieces of information about, for instance, he said that there was a Chevrolet plant, and mm-hmm. I looked it up, and there's a Chevrolet plant in Brazil. Well, lo and behold, there was only two. Oh. And right now it's a GM plant. And so after I found the two locations of the Chevrolet plants, I then knew, you know, he gave information about how large their farm was. I mean, this was a huge farm. Yeah. And there was also like a John Deere location there. That's where they purchased all their John Deere mm-hmm. tractors. And so it just matched up. I mean, I found this location. I started doing Google Street Map views probably over a year. And I eventually wow. found there's only really one location where those anthills are located at.
Yeah.
And then I just happened to have been searching. I said, well, there's no mountaintop, because one of the photos that shows their house is up on top mm-hmm. of the hill. And so I started searching the surrounding towns. And I just happened to have been on Street View, and I was going down the Street View, and I went, oh, my gosh. that's the house.
Well, the other thing that struck me, Ken, is in looking at that photo of the two guys there, behind them, there's a rather distinctive body of water that looks like a river.
Well,
were you able to locate that river?
Well, you know, I will be honest. I thought for years that that was a river. And so I thought that that river that runs through their property was where they were at. But after we really studied it a little bit more with Josh Gates and one of the Brazilian people that they had hired to go with us and kind of interpret. Well, it come to find out there is a major highway that was built from São Paulo all the way into Rio de Janeiro.
Okay.
And that major highway was under construction at that time that photo was taken. And that's what you're looking at. It is a highway that is being constructed.
Wow. Yes.
It's not a body of water?
I thought it was a stream for the longest time.
Oh,
but
wow.
If you look at it, it is actually a road.
Wow.
Really?
Yes.
Bro, it's like a mirage or something.
At that picture painstakingly.
I thought it was a river too, but it was actually a road.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
But there is in the valley where the farms are, it's very rich soil, you know, very good for farming. And there's a huge river that snakes for many, many, many miles. It's a major river in the area. Oh. So, and of course, that's what the brothers had their water source as well.
Well, Mike, let me ask you then, what is your take on what happened to John and Clarence and Frank, for that matter? What do you think, like, actually happened to these guys? You might find this humorous, but I did some research. And, you know, the Federal Department of Corrections will give you pretty much any information you want, as long as you ask nice and say, please. There are three surviving members. It's funny that there's three. There are three surviving Alcatraz inmates alive today, living today. One is 91 years old, one is 94, and one is 96.
Wow.
Alive and well today. One in Illinois, one in Pennsylvania, one in Texas. Okay. Interestingly, none of them are named Morris or Anglin.
Oh, well.
But I thought it was funny.
Right?
I just thought it was funny that there were three guys of the approximate age that they would be today.
Yeah. Right.
But and I pressed them. I said, can I maybe have the names of them? They said, hold on a second, Mr. DeCipio. Let me check for you. And they checked. They went, Lefkowitz. And I went, never mind. I didn't hear the name I'm looking for. I'm looking for Anglin or Morris. They said, oh, are you looking for them Alcatraz boys? That's what the lady said. She said, are you looking for them Alcatraz boys? I said, well, as a matter of fact, I kind of am. She goes, I don't think they're alive no more.
Yeah, we don't think so either. We think, you know, in the tape that Fred Breezy did, he talked about, like Ken mentioned, they had a large farm. They had a lot of workers that work for them. They used to sell their fruits and vegetables in the local market.
Right.
They married, had children. At the time when he did the tape, there were seven children in all. One had four, one had three. And so we think they just, you know, they lived the life that they had dreamed about and had aspired to when they were young boys and eventually did happen for them. Now it came at a price. You know, they couldn't be with their family anymore, so they had to cut off all contact with them. And as far as we know, they never connected with the family in a very specific, tangible way. We think they did it indirectly over the years through sending flowers to the mother, sending Christmas cards through their brother, Robert. Possibly visiting when their mother died, possibly being there dressed as women, kind of standing in the background. There's stories about that.
Yeah.
And then I heard that mentioned this. And then another thing that they used to do through Fred Breezy was they used to record questions to the brothers. Fred would fly him down to Brazil. They would answer the questions and then bring back the cassette and do contact that way. Unfortunately, none of the cassettes have survived. We don't know where they are. They're gone.
Man. Oh,
yeah. So that would be invaluable.
Like a treasure trove. Okay.
So there's no pictures of the
children. You can do voice analysis kind of a thing. So what we think probably happened was, you know, Clarence was a heavy smoker.
Right.
In the photograph for the early 70s photograph, you can see in his shirt pocket, he has a pack of cigarettes in his pocket.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
They probably died at some point some years ago. We don't think they're still alive. And so what we're trying to do now is we're trying to find their family, you know, children and grandchildren. Mm-hmm. You know, we've done DNA testing, haven't been able to find them that way. We're pursuing people in Brazil that can possibly help us get the word out about trying to find the brothers, because what we think is very likely is they changed their names.
Yeah.
To assume names, of course. They don't want to be known as who they are. So what we don't know is, did the family know who they are? Did they know that they were Anglins?
That's the question.
Yeah.
We don't know. That
hounded at Amelia and I.
Yeah.
We talked about this. Go ahead, Amelia. Why don't you?
Yeah. I mean, did they have like you were saying that they had nicknames? Do you think that they might have used, or is there any pictures of their children that you might have found?
None yet. I mean, we do know that they used growing up, and even when they would get into trouble, they would use Clarence was very notorious to use one of his cousins' name.
Mm-hmm.
Alfred actually would use his older brother's name a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And John would, I believe he would go by the name Jerry for some reason. Hmm. I mean, I ain't quite figured out where Jerry came from, but
right.
All of them had nicknames. And I agree with Mike. Once they got down there, you know, I'm not sure the way that Fred told the story when he was meeting with the family in 92, he pretty much, without kind of saying it, you know, he said, you know, if I was them, I would get down there and I would just live my life. And if my brother died, I would bury him and I wouldn't tell anybody about it. And, you know, you don't want to stir up any trouble.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
You pretty much want to fade into the background and live your life and have a good life.
Mm-hmm. And I believe that leads me to the next question, which is, of course, that you know, the Anglin family certainly involved in this, but what about, you know, the family of Frank Morris? Had he any kin that came forward? None at all.
None whatsoever. Frank, you know, and I was thinking about that in the book. You know, we talk about some of the evidence that was recovered.
Yeah.
And in the pouch that they had, all of the letters and all of the photos were assigned and identified as being belonging to John and Clarence. Yeah. And that's really kind of sad, because if you stop and think about it, Morris didn't really have any, he had no family members.
Yeah.
So any letters that he probably received was either from other inmates from other prisons, if he kept in contact with them.
Well,
so it wasn't like John and Clarence that got multiple letters every single day, you know.
It's kind of shameful, you know, Mike and Ken, that Frank Morris, you know, I hate to say this, but from the very beginning of his life, kind of didn't have a half a chance, really. You know, he came from a horrible family. He grew up stealing and petty crimes and just escalated as he got older. He got, you know, the older he got, the worse the crimes got. And he ends up, you know, in federal penitentiary, you know, but your relatives, it's kind of a shame. But, you know, I guess the lesson for me here is that be careful what you ask for, because you just might get it.
Right.
The other lesson here is, you know, sometimes you have to say goodbye to the old life to live the new life.
Yes.
You know, we've seen, you know, history is filled with people who have, quote unquote, died to find their life. Look at one of the most famous cases, real life case. Arthur Rimbaud was a poet and writer. He literally died, you know, and resurfaced like 22 years later on his deathbed. And that's how he went out.
Right.
But he lived the life he wanted to live for 22 years up to that point. You know, it's remarkable to think that maybe, you know, looking back on, I'm going to wax philosophical for a second, but maybe John, Clarence, and Frank, you know, they did what was right for them. They stuck it to the feds. Okay, maybe that's good once in a while to stick it to the feds. You know, Amelia and I are all for that one. Whenever you can stick it to the feds, you know, we applaud you. But don't make a habit out of it, folks.
Right. Not a habit.
That's what prisons are for.
But the other thing is, you know, I suppose, you know, it's bittersweet. If you really think about it, if you put the human face on the story, it's very bittersweet that to gain their freedom, they had to lose who they were.
That's correct.
And that's the story here, I suppose, yep. Really the real lesson. I will tell you what, folks, I want you to take a look at it. Now I'm going to bring myself up here on a big camera, which I don't do that often. But here we go. This is Alcatraz, The Last Escape. The authors are Ken Widener, Mike Lynch. They are the co-authors. They spent a long time, folks, putting this book together. It is a fascinating, when I tell you, a fascinating read. Get the book. It's on Amazon. It's available through Ken and Mike on their Facebook page. And worst comes to worst, you could always come here and get it. We'll sell you a copy and make sure that Ken and Mike get at least a couple bucks anyway. You'll get all the money, fellas. Don't worry about it. I promise you. All we'll do is put a link up there for you. That's it. The book, Alcatraz, The Last Escape, Ken Widener, Mike Lynch. I'll tell you what, fellas. I know this is, I said at the beginning of the show, this is our final part, but maybe not. I might bring you guys back. You know what? Do you guys, are there any other books in you? Because I think there's at least two more books. There's at least two more Alcatraz books in you. You got to do the backstory on all the characters. Nikki Cohen. You got to do Fred Breezy. You got to do the girls. There's another book. Just a
I can spend an hour telling you about Alfred. Alfred has a huge story.
That would be a
this.
Good one.
And yeah. You know, when we first wrote the book, we got to when we first finished it, we were at 500 pages, and
Wow. And
Mike said, "Ken, there is no way they're going to produce a 500 page book." And so I was like, "Well, I still have more to tell."
trust me, I will tell you something. Mm-hmm. So, putting a 500 page book together is nothing easy. I have a bookshelf filled with authors that have been on this show, 500, 600, 700 pages. They read like War and Peace. Mm-hmm. I have a book on the Beatles here that's 674 pages.
I can personally tell you stories that have happened to me with U.S. Marshals.
I got to have you guys back on.
I mean, I have personal stories that actually happened to me with them.
No.
So I can share that's a lot remarkable. Of stuff with you.
I'll tell you what, I'm going to have you guys back on for sure. I got your contact info. I'm going to have you back on. Amelia.
Yes.
What's coming up for us? Let me bring you up on the big camera.
Well, tomorrow we have an exciting show. It's going to be.
Tell me, how exciting is it?
Well, we're going to actually talk about the music business again. It's going to be actually involving two guys that you may have heard of, Aleister Crowley and Anton LaVey.
Anton Zandar LaVey, the created the Church of Satan and wrote the Satanic Bible. God help us.
They actually had a big influence in our music.
And Aleister Crowley influenced people like Bob Dylan, David Bowie, the Beatles, Jimi Hendrix. The list goes on and on. Yeah, that's going to be a show from hell, pardon the pun.
Yeah, really.
We're doing that show tomorrow night. It's going to be an interesting show. The political, social, and pop culture influence of people like Anton LaVey and Aleister Crowley it's scary the impact they've had on music and pop culture. Frightening. It makes your blood run cold.
And still today.
Remarkable. Absolutely remarkable. On behalf of Ken Widener and Mike Lynch, authors of Alcatraz, The Last Escape, on behalf of my co-host, Amelia, the Pitbull Chapman. I'm Mad Dog Angelo DeCipio. I will see you tomorrow night, God willing, and the creek don't rise, on America's Best Podcast, What's the Buzz? Take care, folks. Good night.
Good night, everyone.